Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. This is Dave Gutnick, your host today, sitting in for Don Olson, who's taking a couple weeks break. So we've got a lot to cover as usual today, and I'll briefly summarize. First, we're going to review the ongoing Trump disaster. Then we have an update on Cuba, which we heard about recently on this program. Then a series of Iran war commentaries from various professors and experts and journalists around the world. Then an announcement from our Bets for Peace for a couple things happening next week. And lastly, comments as time allows on the disastrous global impact of the Gulf Wars. All right, so just to remind people, if you need any of the State of Trump, a disaster unfolding with new lows in U.S. administrative behavior, Trump and Hegseth threaten war crimes, Trump likens himself to Jesus, and fights President Vance, scolds the Pope on matters of theology. On the brink of a very important U.S.-Iran diplomatic meeting in Islamabad and hosted by Pakistan, the Secretary of State and the President demonstrated their contempt by attending a UFC wrestling event in Florida. While no diplomats were sent to Islamabad, just two Zionist real estate cronies and the Vice President, and where Vance, over a full day of talks, had to call back to Washington at least 11 times per instructions, plus one more call with Tel Aviv. The talks failed after one day, and a dual blockade of the Strait of Hormuz has reduced sea traffic there by over 90%. Mr. Trump's irresponsibility has left the United States on the cusp of a humiliating strategic defeat. Professor Jeffrey Sachs, who we'll hear from in a minute, says Trump says this: "Don't move or I'll shoot myself." Larry Johnson, we'll also hear from or have heard from on this program, adds, "I had the privilege of interviewing Robert Barnes, an attorney, this morning. Hopefully the video will be posted on Countercurrents by Friday. And he provided shocking details of what is going on behind the scene at the White House. Donald Trump began exhibiting signs of early dementia in September 25. He frequently confabulates, he routinely loses his temper and unleashes screaming rants, and he is incapable of critical thinking. According to Barnes, Trump's senior White House staff are behaving like children with an abusive, drug-addled father, i.e. they walk on eggshells, fearful of saying anything that might ignite Trump's rage." One more note, meanwhile, the world economy is going over the first of several disastrous cliffs or contractions. As we speak, the administration and U.S. media collude to shield the public from the depth of the bad news, while now threatening expansion of the conflict through secondary sanctions against banks in China, the leading trade partner for Iran and 120 other countries. Okay, before we jump into the Iran commentary, though, just briefly on Cuba, a couple updates. I want people to know, I don't have time to quote it, but Bedeya Benjin, who was part of a group visit to Cuba recently, had a good discussion on the Chris Hedges report. And, you know, we're just reliving the 62 missile crisis in a way there. We can't tolerate having any Russian or Chinese facilities of any sort in Cuba. And so, once again, we're threatening war and the embargo, which gets rejected every year by almost every country in the United Nations, except U.S., Israel, and a couple of Pacific Islands, condemned every year our embargo of Cuba, which is completely illegal, as also as cruel. You know, and back then, after the revolution in 59, all other countries except the U.S. negotiated a deal on seized properties after the revolution. And a couple more notes. MDS says there's another flotilla in late April. Check in with Code Pink on that. And there's some people in Congress trying to get a War Powers Act prohibiting Cuban invasion passed. So there's details on that as well. And then I want to mention specifically a note from nakedcapitalism.com, which I've mentioned is a really excellent site. Nakedcapitalism.com has all kinds of good links and stories from all over, covering all kinds of things. This one has to do with Cuba, because immediately after the recent ship arrived with fuel for Cuba, another site reported that a ship carrying diesel equivalent to 250,000 barrels appears to be heading Cuba's way. So the question is whether or not the Trump administration will be willing to let a one-off shipment of Russian oil to Cuba turn into a regular stream of Russian oil and gas for the energy-starved island that almost seven decades worth of U.S. governments have been trying to regime change. And if not, if they won't, what is it prepared to do to stop it? And I want to note before we leave this that similar questions arise regarding China shipments in Persian Gulf. So we'll be coming to that. So here's a statement from a Russian top official. Russia is not going to leave the Western Hemisphere no matter what they say in Washington. They are obsessed with the idea of ousting Russia as well as China from this region. He said Russia's relations with Cuba are of a special nature, both politically and emotionally. Cuba means a lot to the people of Russia. For us, Cubans are brothers, and we cannot just betray Cuba. This is completely out of the question. We cannot leave it to the mercy of fate. That's it on Cuba for today. Now we're going to spend time hearing from various folks on the Iran situation. First, we have Professor Jeffrey Sachs, well-known figure nationally and internationally, and he's on the Duran, which is Alex and Alexander, an excellent program and platform in itself. So here again is Jeffrey Sachs. First, a rather brief clip, and then we'll jump ahead a bit.
Without further ado, let's discuss where we are, and perhaps you can tell us some things about how we got here.
We are literally in Donald Trump's delusions. We're living out in real time the madness of a president of the United States, the likes of which we've never had in our history. In fact, I'm not sure that we've ever had in the nuclear age a leader of a nuclear superpower that is as mentally deranged as this individual. Of course, there's politics, there's backdrop, there are interests, there are many things going on, but there's also delusion. And there's a complete breakdown as well of any governmental process in the United States. What we're watching is the work of We're watching the actions and the impulsive behavior of one person. So let me just try to put that in a little bit of order. Of course, from a structural and systemic point of view, the United States has been in a kind of war with Iran since 1979. And so in a sense, this is a continuation of hostilities that have been maintained for decades. But of course, this is an open war that is on the path of doing untold and profound damage to the entire world economy and perhaps tipping the world into World War III, which is not a small and idle statement or a casual statement, but a reality that we're facing right now. So in one sense, what happened in 1979 was that Iran got out from the grips of the U.S. empire. The U.S. empire had brought Iran under its domination in 1953 when a CIA MI6 coup overthrew the democratically elected government of Iran and installed a police state. And the police state lasted for 26 years. Until the leader of the state weakened in part because of his aging and personal illness, which claimed his life that year. And in that context, the Iranians had a revolution, which was essentially a revolution against the police state. From that moment onward, from 1979, the United States has been in overt regime change operations to try to bring down the revolutionary government. Not so revolutionary anymore, since we're talking about more than four decades later. But from the first moments of Iran escaping from American hegemony in 1979, the United States has tried many means to overthrow the government, including in the early 1980s, funding and arming Saddam Hussein, then an ally of the United States, another puppet of the United States, to invade Iran and actually to use chemical warfare against Iran with the U.S. knowledge and support, in effect. And from that moment as well, the U.S. has been using every economic means, confiscating tens of billions of dollars of Iran's own resources, money in American banks and other financial institutions, sanctions, and periodic military attacks. Now, enter Israel into this, because especially in the age of Benjamin Netanyahu, which began 30 years ago when he first became prime minister, the idea of overthrowing the Iranian government has been front and center of Israel's most fundamental foreign policy. And so when the recent U.S.-Israel war started on Iran a few weeks ago, Netanyahu posted that this was the culmination of 40 years of his dreams. I had been mistaken for years, because I was saying it was 30 years, but I didn't really know the 10 years that preceded his entry to the prime ministership.
So there we have Professor Jeffrey Sachs. I'll be returning to him briefly for that essential background. I know some of you have heard that before, but there's quite a widespread ignorance in United States about how we get into messes like this. And so those are a lot of important details from Sachs. And I want to mention one more thing that I forgot to do by way of intro, because we need to be clear on one of the other origins of this war, and that is the decades of Mideast conflicts, that is, between Israel and the Arab states, not to mention the Persian state, but the Arab states. The conflict rests on Israel's denial of Palestinian rights, Palestinians being largely Arab, largely Muslim, but also Christian and other religions there. Israel has been denying Palestinian rights, territory, dignity, and lives. So this is why we hear of Arab hostility for all those reasons since 1948, and even before that. It's founded on denying Palestine equality. Israel is the last and worst legacy of British imperialism, inherited by the U.S. That's my own commentary on the whole affair. And also, I believe Netanyahu wants to wreck any negotiation or ceasefire. He said he's been dreaming of war, as Sachs just mentioned, for 40 years, the culmination of his Greater Israel project. So that's what we face there, and I think Trump is manifesting some of the worst of U.S. character. It's violent, reckless, self-righteous, and supremacist. Historian John Mearsheimer adds, think about the depth to which the U.S. has sunk. Where are the protests? The U.N. and Geneva Convention are being destroyed by the U.S. and Israel. And I'm going to come back to Sachs, but I want to mention one thing. I don't think it's in this tape section, but he makes the common mistake of attributing to Mark Twain an expression that's actually by Ambrose Bierce, who's an equally brilliant but not as prolific American writer. And the statement is, war is nature's way of teaching geography to Americans. So now all of a sudden people know where the Strait of Hormuz is and the Persian Gulf. So here's back to the causes of the war. Let me find the right spot here.
criminality. He's also an indicted war criminal. He is Donald Trump's peer in all of this. So this is also structural. The war is structural in that it is a war for U.S. global dominance and for Israel's regional dominance. It also, just so everybody, we can all be on the same page, everyone is right to say it's also about money, because that's what dominance is about. Trump chortles with delight that he will grab the oil, that we'll all get rich. The man is a moron, by the way, but this is his level of thinking, will grab the oil. It's also, yes, about the military-industrial complex. We have a lot of very sick people in our country, in the United States, many of them in Silicon Valley, and many of them are testing their weapon systems right now. And so this AI weaponization is part of the purpose of this war. One of the biggest boosters of this war is Palantir, which has a lead contract of the Pentagon for AI-empowered battlefield management, including the murder of 160 schoolgirls, because the first thing that this system got wrong was this military target. So there are many forces at play in any major event, but basically any sane president would have said, no, this is risky. It's likely to fail. It's against international law. It's even, we might have had a few presidents to say it's immoral. Not all of them would have said that, but many of them would have said that. But it took an individual of mental instability and perhaps dementia to say, let's go for it, and a complete deinstitutionalization of American systems. We don't have governance systems right now. We don't have a constitutional order right now. We don't have Congress playing any role whatsoever right now. We don't even have an executive branch that functions in a systemic way right now. So we have the personalization of politics with a mentally unstable leader and all of these structural factors that have gone back for decades that have brought us to this moment. Final word before I turn it back over to you is it's a catastrophe. This is a catastrophe. It's a man-made global economic crisis that is likely, not just can, but is likely to intensify and spread out of control. And that means a mass economic crisis, hunger, deprivation, political instability, maybe World War III. So this is where we are.
So a grim but accurate picture there by Professor Jeffrey Sachs. I'm just going to give him about 3 or 4 more minutes because given the extreme dangerous situation, he poses what may seem a somewhat unlikely intervention by leading powers. I have speculated that the financial catastrophe that is unfolding will be the proximate cause of bringing an end to it one way or another. He believes that will lead to major power intervention. I'll let him explain that.
Structural U.S. arrogance, and there is a mental instability of Trump, and there is a pairing with Netanyahu, and there is a generalized decline of restraint right now that we've seen during the Ukraine war, and we see it now, where the line of nuclear weapons and not is not taken as the bright red line by any means. And just to add, finally, if one studies the whole nuclear age, the whole atomic age, going back to 1945, That line has never really existed. And there have always been, in every crisis, voices in senior positions in the United States that have said, go nuke them. Go do it. Why not? And that, of course, was true in the original use of the two atomic bombs in Japan, which were completely, totally unnecessary militarily and were made for demonstrative purposes. It was true during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was true at many other points. So we should just be absolutely worried sick about this. And it raises the ultimate question, so what can stop this dynamic right now? And there are two kinds of answers to that, neither of which is utterly satisfactory, but one is the internal checks in the United States. Are there grown-ups in the U.S. system? Are there grown-ups and not sycophants or crazy people? Because we've got a mix of crazy people, self-interested, greedy people, and sycophants around Trump. We don't have a process. We don't have government functioning. We don't have what John Mearsheimer calls a government that thinks. We don't have a rational process. So can there be one? Can the congressional leaders understand that actually it's their oath and their constitutional responsibility not to be as pathetic as they have been in recent months, cowering for fear of Mr. Trump? Internally, Director of National Intelligence, head of the CIA, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What if they get an order that's absolutely risking a catastrophe? What happens? So this is one issue. Can there be an internal check? Because it may very well be needed. And second, what about externally? I believed throughout this whole crisis that there are only three people in the world that are of interest to Donald Trump because he wants to be in their club. And that's President Putin, President Xi Jinping, and Prime Minister Modi. The other, I consider the four, the United States, Russia, China, and India, to be the world's four superpowers. And Trump, in his delusional world, also needs to be in their club. So if they speak to him together and say, Donald, sit down, have a tea, let's calm down, let's have a nice chat. That actually could make a difference. I don't see any other leader providing that kind of safety for us.
So there you have it. And is there going to be internal opposition in the U.S.? Well, it's pretty slow to mobilize. It is there, but it's going to have a lot more happening at the Washington, D.C. level. So that's, again, Professor Jeffrey Sachs on the Duran, a great program. And I want to add a couple things, and then we'll go on to another speaker. But, you know, the obviously bad mistakes here are even penetrating the mainstream, which usually does not occur when it's a matter of the U.S. imperial adventures. But the New York Times, two or three very strong statements against it now in recent days by the editors, laying out what everybody should know. The recklessness of his war has become clearer yet. He has disdained careful military planning and acted on gut instinct and wishfulness. After Netanyahu predicted to Mr. Trump that the attacks would inspire a popular uprising in Iran, the director of the CIA counted that the notion was farcical, the Times reported. Mr. Trump proceeded nevertheless. us. He was so confident that he assembled no plan to respond to an obvious countermove available to Iran, causing a spike in oil prices by blocking the Strait of Hormuz. Nor did he develop a feasible strategy for securing the enriched uranium that Iran can use to rebuild its nuclear program. And then well-known author David Wallace Wells, a columnist in the Times on occasion, talked about the fact that this whole adventure is blowing a hole in the U.S. military budget because we have one drone measured in millions of dollars blown out by one that cost a few thousand. And now they've taken out a $500 million, that's $500 million surveillance plane. Wallace Wells said, Americans got addicted to the promise of one-sided warfare they glimpsed in the first Gulf War, so addicted they haven't really noticed that in none of the mini-wars, quasi-wars, air wars, and drone wars which followed, did the U.S. win unambiguous victories. Once again, nothing's changing with the strait being restricted. There's some boats are getting through with permission from Iran and payment in renminbi or cryptocurrency, which are free from sanctions. But the state of the blockade remains ambiguous and disputed because the U.S. ships are not right at the Gulf, but they're in the Gulf of Oman. They're not right at the Strait of Hormuz, but they are out there and are attempting. It's actually somewhat infeasible, according to several people, but they are trying to obstruct the traffic. So there's a lot of ambiguity, fog of war, as well as different treatment of different nations and different boats and so on. So Larry Johnson, former CIA officer, today reports, certainly not the first time that the Department of War and a theater commander have issued false reports in order to persuade the citizens of the U.S. that the war is going our way. The reality is that the U.S. still does not have enough ships in place, along with helicopters, to carry out an effective blockade. Moreover, the U.S. is keeping its ships at least 500 miles from the Iranian coast, out of fear of being struck. One more from Yves French, the Naked Capitalism editor. Do I think this blockade will hold? I doubt it. First, as even a Times of London radio broadcast mentioned early on, even if this strangulation were to succeed on a longer-term basis, it would not do damage to Iran all that quickly. By contrast, it will lead to a much faster compounding of the damage to the global economy. I'm going to go on to Professor Mohammad Randi. He's in Tehran, an Iranian who was part of the recent meetings in Islamabad. And given the Israeli and U.S. habit of assassinating leaders and negotiators, they were under considerable threat. And they talked about it, and here Professor Randi talks about it a bit himself. And I'm going to give him about 5 or 6 minutes, see if I can find the right spot here.
Said he's leaving, it was over. And we were just planning how to come back. And because of the Washington Post calling on us to be murdered, and many American pundits also calling for us to be murdered, and also me again by name, being called in online, people calling for me to be murdered, not the bounty that we had a few weeks ago, but all of us were now, in fact, on the way to Islamabad, the other people in the delegation were making fun of me, and they were saying, you know, there's a bounty on your head, and we're going to hand you over, and we have debts, and we want to, you know, buy an apartment, you know, different people would say that. And then on the way back, I said, well, you're not going to get, you're all in trouble just like me. So, you know, we were joking about it on the way and on the way back. Really, these men and women who were on the plane were very courageous. And their only concern was the Speaker of Parliament. They just didn't want anything bad to happen to him because they wanted him to be able to, play the role that he's played during the last month and a half in leading the resistance, playing his role in the resistance against this aggression. Of course, I mean, even as I think everyone is by now has seen, Iran is not dependent, nor the axis of resistance, dependent on individuals. And they can murder one person and someone else will take their place and the resistance will continue. But in any case, people were more concerned about Dr. Ghalibaf than they were concerned about themselves.
What is the real story behind these negotiations? It was all what we've learned, that Iran has somehow sent its 10-point proposal to Pakistan, then to the United States, that Donald Trump himself agreed on those points to negotiate on. And how come, right, you know, hours before Iranian delegation going to Islamabad, they were still bargaining, talking about, you know, the attacks on Lebanon, the ceasefire in Lebanon. The other part was, you know, the Strait of Hormuz and, you know, the enrichment uranium. What was that? What was the main, let's put it this way, how did Iran manage the whole situation with the 10-point plan? What was the main problem, in your opinion?
Well, from the very beginning, as you recall, the Americans were, the Trump was saying unconditional surrender. And then, because they thought the war was going to end quickly, like in a couple of days. And then they said, well, you know, they're running out of missiles and drones. Like after a few days, they'll run out. They were showing these charts how Iran was no longer firing missiles anymore, or small numbers, and then drones. And then that didn't work. So gradually it evolved and his position changed until he put out a 15-point plan, Trump. And the Iranians said, that's nonsense. It's just a non-starter. And so the Iranians put their plan forward, that 10-point plan that people have seen. And Trump accepted to have this as a framework. And so this clearly indicates that Trump was in trouble. It clearly indicates that things were not going well on the battlefield. So we accepted. And then, of course, Trump backtracked and they said, we threw this in the dustbin or the garbage. And it just shows that, you know, Trump and the people around him in the White House, they're all, you know, they have no credibility. They have no honesty. They have no honor. They have no humanity. They're empty shells. And the people around him are, of course, all yes men. So, and he's props a yes man too. I mean, who knows why he behaves like this? Who knows? It's like, it's for me, it sounds increasing like he's done really terrible things to little girls or something like that. But who knows? So when they came to the negotiating table, the Americans in Islamabad, the, you know, during the first few hours, it could have been said that it was generally positive. Arguments, that, you know, disagreements, but it was generally positive. But at the end, it suddenly went downhill very fast. And it was clear that they did not have a mandate, or that Vance did not have a mandate. Unlike the Iranians, who had a mandate, even though the Iranians came with great skepticism, the Iranians didn't come expecting an agreement. At least those who I spoke to, and Dr. Ghalibaf, no doubt, and you know others that I, the others in the delegation I spoke, none of them had any expectations, and they won the war. They had no reason to give to appease Trump or the United States. They could have provided him with an off ramp without losing anything, just so that he could find a way out of this and pretend that he won or whatever. But they were not going to give up their rights or give some concession to the United States. They could, you know, create a, I don't know, they could cloud, they could, you know, muddy the waters and maybe he could, you know, escape somehow. But that's all they could do, I would guess. But at the end, you know, Vance constantly making phone calls and then suddenly going, you know, in a different direction. And then afterwards, without telling the Iranians, he just walks away and leaves. It just, you know, it's impossible to interpret what is really going on because of Trump. So now we have a blockade. Okay, this is a blockade. You blockaded your own proxies in the Persian Gulf. And then he revises the blockade, which is not going to change anything because Iran is not going to allow them to use their ports if Iran can't use its ports. Who knows? You know, so he's basically punishing the world. He's pushing the world faster and into deeper economic crisis. To what avail? Is he going to change Iranian policy? Definitely not.
So that again is Professor Mohammad Mirandi, geopolitical analyst at the University of Tehran, being interviewed on the Nima Al-Kashid site, which is excellent. Nima is a Iranian by origin, and now he's broadcasting out of Brazil. Site is called Dialogue Works. And before we have a little couple more clips, I want to make an important local announcement. And this is coming from Bets for Peace and Barry Reich, Minnesota Bets for Peace Chapter 27 Membership Chair, and our friend David Logston have made sure we got this. And this is two things, events that are next week, sponsored by Veterans for Peace on Earth Day, April 22nd. We'll be screening Abby Martin's Empire Files. So we have our own new film premiering locally, Empire Files by Abby Martin, documenting 5 years in the making and dealing with the impact in the U.S. military has on the earth, air, and climate crisis. Even though all days should be Earth Day, it is still appropriate we show it then. If in doubt about its impact, your mind will be changed after viewing this film, which would be good to have everyone, at least in this country, view. And this is being shown, the screening of The Earth's Greatest Enemy, at McAllister College, Bruce Stricker, Dayton Building, McAllister Campus Center, 1300 Grand Avenue, St. Paul, 6:30 p.m. on the 22nd, with a suggested donation, but no one will be turned away. Then the second bit is from Bets for Peace, co-sponsoring an Earth Day event on Saturday, April 18th. The rally begins at the Minneapolis Government Center at 1 p.m., and they will march to the Minneapolis Commons Park, 425 Portland Avenue South, where a program will begin at 2 p.m. We hope you will attend both events, and we could use help at both with flyering, tabling, and ushering. So that's from Bets for Peace. Hope to see some of you there. And now we have popular with some corners of the internet, Professor Zhang Zuqin, a Chinese academic and host of the site Productive History. And he's talking about what he sees as the key strategic elements in the war going on, namely the petrodollar. And he's going to be on just for a few minutes. Let me get him on here.
That right now, this war in Iran, it's primarily about maintaining the petrodollar. Because these past 10 years, the world has become increasingly concerned about the viability of the petrodollar. Right now, the United States is $39 trillion in debt. The United States, right after the Russians invaded Ukraine, froze over $200 billion in Russian assets, which makes the world question the legitimacy as well as the credibility of the U.S. financial system. Because if the Americans can weaponize the U.S. dollar against the Russians, they can weaponize the U.S. dollar against everyone. So after that, you saw this massive exodus from U.S. treasuries. And right now, China is establishing the gold corridor. So BRICS is trying to create alternatives to the petrodollar. But for the Americans, the petrodollar is the very basis of their empire. And quite honestly, it's the very it's the objective of their empire. So the United States right now is going to fight tooth and nail to protect the petrodollar. What this basically means is to use its naval supremacy, its control over strategic choke points, maritime choke points, to control trade access and basically force nations to depend on U.S. resources. So we saw that the United States in January attacked Venezuela, and now it's attacked Iran. Recently, these past few days, there was a Ukrainian drone strike on Russia's main export hub, which basically took off 40% of Russian oil from the global market. And so Europe and East Asia are now forced to depend on the United States, North America, for energy. And right now we're seeing a pivot from Europe and East Asia over to North America. And so that's a strategy in place where the United States basically wants to take off Russian GCC oil and force the world to buy from the United States, which protects the petrodollar. But what we know from history is that this sort of hubris will lead to a backlash, and it will lead to the world unifying against America eventually, because quite honestly, America used to be the policeman of the world, and now it's become the pirate of the world.
I wanted to get to that. I think that it's not only witty, but really insightful. U.S. was the policeman of the world, now we're the pirate of the world. That's Professor Jang. I've made a mistake. His site is called Predictive History, and he's a regular appearance on some of the interviews, too. He's being interviewed here by Glenn Deason, the Norwegian professor. And I have one more bit from that also ends with a real zinger from Professor Jang. And let's see, let me find that.
Listen to what he said all the way going back to the 1980s. He was essentially scolding all the Japanese and others for you know, taking advantage of the U.S. the way he saw it. So he didn't say that we shouldn't have a big empire. He just said the empire, they should pay us for the privilege of being protected. So it's not that he didn't want an empire. It seemed he just wanted a better return on investment. That is, you know, you have to monetize the empire somehow. Otherwise, the empire will kill off the republic. So in other words, it should feed it. It looks as this is where his main difference is, but that means not just extracting from adversaries, but also allies. I don't think it's limited to Trump. I think overall the United States will tilt more and more in this direction, because as they have, as you said, they exhausted themselves with $39 trillion in the hole. It's not as if you can vote for a Democrat and suddenly they go back to paying for the security of allies anymore and having generous trade agreements. There's no going back after, you know, exhausted to this extent.
Yeah, so this is a really important point that you make, okay? So remember, in 2016, when Trump first came into office, he was saying the same things you're saying, which is everyone's taking advantage of us, especially China. So let's impose tariffs and make sure that that it's America first, that America is winning in this trade relationship. But after Trump left office, Biden came in with the Democrats and they institutionalized his policies, okay? So in the first Trump administration, a lot of it was personal, especially his tariff war against China. And then Biden and the Democrats made it institutional. And so we can expect the same process here, where maybe Trump leaves office in 2028, the Republicans lose, the Democrats come into office, and they won't change anything. All they're going to do is institutionalize it and make it a long-term sustainable policy, because this is what benefits the American empire.
There again, I think Glenn Deason actually first introduced the expression that the empire would kill the republic, and I think that's a capsule history of what's happened to the United States. Okay, we're getting toward the end. I've got one or two more things we can run here and some more good quotes from the media. Aaron Maté, a great journalist, he collaborates with Max Blumenthal on The Gray Zone, and an excellent commentator. He's on Judge Napolitano being interviewed just a day or two ago, and again, giving a little historical background to reiterate and expand upon some of the things that have been said today. So here's Aaron Maté on the Judge Napolitano show.
With this vision of him being a hero who would liberate Iran and be the guy who finally took care of the Islamic Republic. And I think given he's just completely unhinged and driven by ego and a desire to spread a hegemony, he went with it. And of course, as we're now seeing, it was a, at least from the point of view of regime change, it was a failure.
Mm. To what lengths will Netanyahu go to disrupt any efforts, whether they're substantial or performative? We'll get into that in a minute as to what really happened in Islamabad, but to disrupt them.
Well, he'll kill civilians, as we saw on Black Wednesday in Lebanon last week, launching these attacks at hundreds of residential civilian sites, killing well over, I think in one day the toll was over 300 people. And he did that specifically to provoke Iran, because he knows that Iran is not going to abandon Hezbollah and just let Israel continue to run wild and accept, and meanwhile have Iran accept a ceasefire. So that's the main thing he'll do, is just commit violence and aggression. It's what he always does. He's done that in Gaza, where there was a ceasefire. I remember last March, he broke that ceasefire despite no violations by Hamas, and he's continued to break it. So I think that's his main mode, is aggression. And then you have the Israel lobby. They'll come through with a pressure campaign if they need to. And we know, Netanyahu even bragged about this, that J.D. Vance was reporting to him from Islamabad. So I don't know what Netanyahu was telling him, but certainly Netanyahu does not want to see any diplomacy coming out of those talks.
That again is Aaron Maté, and I did want to play one more brief thing from him, but I want to move on to the energy and economic situation. We're going to return to Aaron Maté when his new book comes out, which is about Russiagate as background to the current crisis, something I feel is extremely important. So we have the remaining portion to talk about the energy framework, something I've been personally studying and trying to learn about for quite a few years, because it's overlooked. Energy is the economy. It's not like other commodities. It's not easily substitutable, especially the best of the petroleum. And so there's a lot of misconceptions among mainstream and everyday thinking about the economy when we're just going to face an enormous crisis starting like right now. And so here's some commentary on this that I've been following. Energy inputs are what allows industrial civilization. Cessation of energy inputs creates damage to supply chains. And these are real physical things consumed by people with real physical butterfly or ripple effects, not some abstract formula that can be fixed like a formula on a chalkboard. What this means is that while extremely brilliant people like Mearsheimer know what is coming and are sounding the alarm, the terminology does not exist that communicates the criticality of the situation. It would be a term that conveys the horror of war, the horror of starvation. Quote, worse than the Great Depression, unquote, does not work to communicate the criticality of the past being chosen. Some more quotes. South and East Asian countries are already imposing rationing and cutting labor force hours. Did you know that? The impact is now. South Korea's president on the energy crisis says, it's a situation so serious that even I can't sleep. And here's the well-known economist in the New York Times, ending with my point about the energy being so crucial. Krugman says, ever since this war began, I've noticed a sharp divide in sentiment among experts. Finance and macroeconomics experts have been relatively sanguine about our ability to ride out this storm. But talk to or read energy experts, people who focus on the physical side of the oil crisis, and their hair is on fire. Another favorite site that I follow is Gail Tverberg at Our Finite World. OurFiniteWorld.com, really a great site with great reader interaction. And the readers are all over the map, too. Believe me, there's no unity of opinion there. But she posts monthly at a really extensive analysis of the energy constraints in the world. And her latest one, get this title, Losing the Iran War May Be the Best Outcome for the World. And here's some of her comments. All of the underlying problems are still around. There is too much wage disparity and too much debt. There isn't enough diesel and jet fuel. The U.S. doesn't have critical minerals. Israel thinks it needs more land for its people. Now we have shortages of things like helium and fertilizer besides. Trump says America doesn't need the Strait of Hormuz. Who put that idea in his head? The U.S. imports 8 million barrels a day, either refined products or heavy crude, to balance its refineries. It has four times the petrol dependency per capita of the United Kingdom. And internal U.S. prices of jet fuel, diesel, fertilizers, sulfur, needed for copper and mineral processing, and aluminum are all shaped by the Gulf through global markets. The Gulf is the source of approximately global exports of one-third of fertilizer, especially urea and ammonia, one-third of helium, the essential for chip and other manufacturing processes, one-half of sulfuric acid, a great deal of natural gas, one-fourth of plastics from the naphtha ingredients, one-fourth of petroleum, and significant jet fuel and diesel. A different author says, and this is not just any old oil, it is the high net energy stuff, so that in energy terms, the loss to the economy is far greater than 20%. A lot of the oil we are now left with is lower net energy, and so economic activity will have to decline accordingly. So, a couple more quotes. This is from a site called Shanakan's Lemperara. I don't know what that even means, but it's quite the paragraph. Listen to this. The 2026 Iran war has exposed a concentration of industrial dependency so extreme that a single geological formation, i.e. around the Persian Gulf, processed through equipment manufactured by five companies. This is just one of the ingredients I referred to, that he's talking about, especially equipment that has only five manufacturers in the whole world. Okay, a single geological formation processed through equipment manufactured by five companies shipped through one 39-kilometer strait simultaneously powers the production of the chips in your phone, the fertilizer in the fields that feed 3 billion people, the aluminum in your aircraft, the gas-to-liquids fuel in military jets, the petrochemicals in every plastic object within arm's reach, and the desalinated water that keeps 100 million Gulf residents alive. No financial model, no supply chain risk assessment, no sovereign wealth fund stress test, and no central bank scenario analysis ever connected these dependencies into a single picture. The market priced each node independently, assigning near zero probability to simultaneous failure. On February 28th, 26, that probability resolved to one. So, some more on the energy situation, and this is from a site called Undenial. How appropriate. And going through all the false and confusing and unconvincing reasons for the war that have been offered by officialdom, and just all over the map. I'm sure you've heard a number of them in any comments. Each of these explanations no doubt motivates different groups. However, none of them are the reason the U.S. attacked Iran. To retain its power, the U.S. must defend its reserve currency, and to do so needs the world's strongest military. U.S. military strength is dependent on many rare earth minerals, and China controls almost all of them. To retain its military power and reserve currency, the U.S. needs leverage to force China to provide it with rare earth minerals, and the U.S. intends to use Iran's oil as that leverage. You'll hear this an echo of some of Professor Jiang's comments we heard a little bit ago. Back to the quote, U.S. leaders can't possibly say that if China does not provide rare earth minerals, the U.S. military will be weak and the U.S. will lose reserve currency status and the standard of living for Americans will fall 50% plus. So instead, we have to kill thousands of Iranians and spend billions of dollars and risk World War III and risk collapsing the global economy to try to force China to give them to us. Again, none of the reasons U.S. leaders have provided for attacking Iran, nor the additional reasons pundits have provided, are even close to the real reason. So the analysis there is we're in a bind on the rare earth minerals, and we only have the potential cutting off of oil to China as our weapon to bargain on that. That's pretty much it. I want to make sure I recommend some other sites and things we haven't had time to go through today. There's a professor called Dr. Warwick Powell. He's got a Substack site and author of a book. I think the title alone is intriguing to me, given what I said earlier about the importance of energy. The book is titled Thermodynamics in a Time of Monsters. Thermodynamics being what we touched on a few minutes ago, but also the title refers to famous quote from Gramsci, the Italian intellectual and revolutionary, and he said, "The old world is dying, the new world is struggling to be born. It is a time of monsters. A great variety of morbid symptoms emerge." That was a description of 90 years ago, but applies to today as well. I want to also recommend a couple of other sites. Kurt Cobb, C-O-B-B, has a site called Resource Insights. Resource Insights offers nice capsule discussion in a very informed manner of Resource Insights, some of which we've touched on today. And I've mentioned, I want to make sure you're aware of consortiumnews.com. Run by great journalists and former intelligence people. And that's consortiumnews.com. And then also the interviews I've mentioned today at Dialogue Works by Nima Al-Kashid, Dialogue Works. And then the interviews by Pascal Lataz, who's Swiss, but he's in Japan. His site is called Neutrality Studies. That's Neutrality Studies. These are all on YouTube, and several of these people have Substack pages as well. So I kind of ran through my list here. Got a few minutes left, and I don't have anybody else to call on. Let me see if I've got anything that I still want to cover that I didn't mention. Other sites, Judge Napolitano, we've heard from him many times. Professor Jiang, J-I-A-N-G, and his site is Productive History. Predictive History, sorry. And Professor Morandi is always informed discussion of the point of view from Iran. And so, let's see. A little bit more from David Wallace Wells. This is actually the New York Times of just yesterday, for the last couple minutes here. How long had it taken Americans to realize they'd gotten stuck in quagmires in Iraq and Afghanistan? In this war of choice, conducted largely by air, the fearsome U.S. military had gotten trapped in a war of attrition within the very first week. Pretty much every time an American interceptor missile destroyed a Shahid drone, it blew a hole in the U.S. military budget measured in millions of dollars. It blew one in the Iranian budget measured in the tens of thousands. And those were the encounters logged as American successes. When the drones and missiles did get through, they could take out a $500 million American surveillance plane. And again, you heard this sentence before. Americans got addicted to the promise of one-sided warfare they glimpsed in the first Gulf War. So addicted, they haven't really noticed that in none of the many wars, quasi-wars, air wars, and drone wars which followed, did the U.S. win unambiguous victories. So what is it going to take for the U.S. to humbly admit that it's made a lot of mistakes and it needs to reverse track? Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
It's dark outside. You turn on the back deck light to look over the area where you keep the bird feeder and put out corn for the deer. And what's that? A little gray furry thing the size of a chipmunk, with enormous brown eyes almost the size of its head. You've just been given a privileged sight of one of Minnesota's most elusive critters, the flying squirrel. There are two species of flying squirrel in Minnesota, the southern and slightly larger northern flying squirrel. They're nocturnal, and their large eyes help them see at night. Flying squirrels nest in holes in trees and our superb climbers and gliders, which is a good thing because they're horribly awkward on the ground. That's because of their wings, actually their flaps of skin, which help them fly. And to be accurate, flying squirrels don't fly. They glide, capturing air with their skin folds and using their flat tails as stabilizers and brakes. The omnivorous creatures also love seeds and are known to haunt bird feeders after the birds have flown home for the night.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
This is a test of the emergency alert system.